Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record, program number 1052, interview number 21 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiGiamio, the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed, about the JFK assassination and New Orleans DA Jim Garrison's investigation of same. Jim, welcome back to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
Now, we've been talking about Jim Garrison and all of the various things that happened to him when he did a very honest investigation of the killing of JFK. His was not, however, the last investigation. A fellow we'll talk about named Gaetan Fonzi wrote a book called The Last Investigation, and that was about the House Select Committee on Assassination, which will be the focal point of our next two programs. How did that come to pass? So you may want to explain to younger listeners who might not have any memory of that what that was and how that came to pass.
The House Select Committee on Assassinations came to fruition in the latter part of 1976 as a result of, I believe, three major events. All right, the first one, and I believe the most important one, was the 1975 telecast of the Zapruder film on ABC television by Geraldo Rivera, Bob Gross, Dick Gregory.
Okay, hang on. You dropped out for just a second. Bob Groden, was that?
Bob Groden, right. And the late comedian Dick Gregory.
Okay.
All right. Now, that was, I believe, in the summer of 1975. That was the first time any kind of mass audience had ever seen the Zapruder film, all right? And that, I was actually around then, all right? And you were too.
Sure.
And I distinctly remember the feeling I had watching that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was literally, I remember exactly where I was, okay? I was at a bar in my hometown of Erie, Pennsylvania, and I remember, I don't know if my jaw dropped, but that's the feeling I remember having watching that film, you know, because obviously the most shocking thing about the Zapruder film is the exceedingly fast reaction of Kennedy going backwards in his back seat with such force that he literally bounces off the back of the chair.
Yeah.
You know, and if you know, as almost everybody does, that we are supposed to believe that Oswald was shooting from behind, you're left with a rather serious problem in physics.
Not only that, Jim, but when you actually see the Zapruder film, not only is Kennedy's body not just slammed against the rear of the seat and he's moved to his right, but he's actually lifted up to an extent by the shot. I mean, it is a powerful impact and reaction by Kennedy's body. And even beyond that, when you see a wider angle or some of the still photographs of the headshot, Kennedy's head exploded and
right.
was blown all over the back of the limousine. And there is no way that the quote jet effect, and if time permits, we can get into that.
Yeah, this case, the other side brings up so many stupid, lousy excuses that it actually gets funny, you know, once you try to elucidate them, you know. But that, the point we're trying to make here is that film shocked literally hundreds of thousands of people who saw it that night, to the point that it now became a conversation piece the next day in at YMCAs, in offices, you know, at your local gathering of, friends and family, at your local bar, at your local hamburger place. It put the JFK case back on the map. That's how powerful it was. Now, there were a couple of other things that we should mention. All right. There was also the church committee. All right. Now, the church committee was also in 1975. It's named after its chairman, the late Senator Frank Church of Idaho. And this was a result, really, if you really want to trace it, it was a result of the whole Watergate scandal. Because there were certain people in Congress, like Howard Baker, who were puzzled by the role of the CIA in the whole Watergate thing. And so they began to organize an intelligence committee, and that's what the church committee was. It was really the first full-scale investigation of the FBI and the CIA and how they had violated their charters. And so for the first time, you actually had, you know, intelligence officials like Bill Colby and Dick Helms, you know, actually testifying to Congress about some of the terrible things that the CIA and the FBI had done. Okay? Now, there were two senators on the church committee who were interested in the JFK case. They were Richard Schweiker of Pennsylvania and Gary Hart of Colorado. So Frank Church allowed them to organize a subcommittee, all right? And this, of course, was called the Schweiker-Hart Committee. And he gave them the mandate of not actually investigating the Kennedy assassination as such, but to show the problems that the Warren Commission would have by relying so much on the FBI and the CIA for their information. And this was a very interesting report, okay? It was the first really strong criticism of the Warren Commission from another governmental body. So this is another thing that began to push the JFK case back into the forefront. And there was one other point that I should bring up. That was the belated discovery of the so-called Oswald Note. Okay? Now, what do I mean by that, the Oswald Note? The FBI had done everything they could to cover up this alleged note that Oswald had left at FBI headquarters a couple of weeks before the assassination, all right? And it had been pretty much covered up until somehow it broke in the news in 1975 again that a couple of weeks before the assassination, Oswald had gone to the FBI office in Dallas, left a note for Jim Hostie. Jim Hostie was the FBI agent in the Dallas-Fort Worth area who was supposed to be monitoring Oswald's case, all right? And no, to this day, nobody knows what the note said because the FBI destroyed the note, all right, afterwards, all right? Because obviously, if Oswald is at FBI, you got the guy right in FBI headquarters, and he's not on your security list, he's not on the people that you go ahead and give to the Secret Service about we better watch out for this guy, especially if the note said what the hearing said it said, which was leave my wife alone or I'm going to blow up the FBI office. Now, I want to say this. Nobody's ever going to know what the note said, but that was the as they say, the conventional wisdom as to what it did say. So those three things, the Zapruder film, the church committee, and the discovery, the belated discovery of the Oswald note, are the three things that went ahead and pushed into fruition a new investigation of the JFK murder.
And ultimately, Representative Tom Downing, I believe he was a representative, not a senator, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a congressman. Tom Downing deserves a lot of credit for getting this thing off the ground. His son was a member of Mark Glane's Citizens Inquiry, all right? And this was a volunteer organization organized throughout the country that was campaigning for the creation of a new investigation. And so because he was a member of that committee, he got to know Bob Groden, and he saw the Zapruder film, and he arranged for his father to get a private screening of the film, all right? And like almost everybody else, he was very much impressed. Okay, the dramatic impact on him was it was for almost all normal people, you know, shocking. And so Tom Downing then became more or less the leader in the House of Representatives, all right, to campaign to go ahead and get a committee formed in order to reinvestigate the case.
And that was the House Select Committee. We will be talking as we get into the history of what happened with this committee about the changing of the guard. And boy, was there ever a changing of the guard. But some of the initial people who came to work for the House Select Committee were very good indeed. Tell us about Richard Sprague, the first chief counsel.
Okay. Dick Sprague was a very distinguished district attorney from Philadelphia, who by an incredible amount of irony actually used to work for Arlen Specter, all right? Sprague had been trying criminal cases for a very long time, all right? And he was very successful. I think if I, don't quote me this verbatim, but if I remember correctly, his record was something like 73-1 or something like that, okay, over the number of years, cases he had personally tried to a jury verdict, right? And so he had also done a very good job on what people call the Jock Yablonski murder case. That was a very high profile, at least in Pennsylvania, murder conspiracy. Done over a union dispute between Jock Yablonski, who was a reform candidate, all right, and Tony Boyle, who was the incumbent president of, I think it was, a coal miners union.
Yeah, it was coal miner. I think United Coal Miners. I've forgotten their exact name. That was the industry in which they were involved, and obviously in Pennsylvania, the coal industry is very influential.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, that ended up being a murder conspiracy. And what happened is that they appointed Dick Sprague, okay, to go ahead and investigate that case. And he did, let's put it this way, he not only convicted Boyle once, but since the case was reversed on appeal, he actually did it twice, okay? All right? And so he developed a kind of high profile in that regard, all right? And so he was one of the candidates that the House Select Committee decided to talk to, All right. And so after several weeks of negotiations between Downing and Sprague, Sprague agreed to take the job. All right. And he then, because he was going to be the overall chief counsel, he appointed somebody to run the JFK part of the probe, because there were going to be two separate probes, one in the JFK, one for MLK, one for King. So the deputy counsel in charge of the JFK case ended up being a guy named Bob Tannenbaum. Bob Tannenbaum was a very accomplished district attorney in New York, and he actually ran the homicide division. All right. If I remember this correctly, Tannenbaum's record was, from a sheer one loss, was even better than Sprague's, because Tannenbaum never lost a felony case, of any case that he was the actual prosecutor. All right.
Okay.
I mean, there was one or two cases where he got an undecided jury, but he went ahead and retried the case, and then he won on the second time around. So here you had, if you ask me, this was pretty much the opposite of what you had in the Warren Commission. If you take a look at what the Warren Commission did, the Warren Commission, most of those guys, if you follow their careers, okay, most of those guys ended up going into the civil side of the law, you know, like trusts, estates, business law, contract law. They ended up being civil lawyers. Whereas with Sprague and Tannenbaum, you had two guys who were very, very experienced and very proficient criminal lawyers who specialized in murder cases. So you really had, for the first time, what looked like was going to be a really serious criminal investigation into what happened to President Kennedy. And because of this, because of the rush of excitement and exhilaration that took place around this, you literally had, and I'm not exaggerating at all, you had thousands of young college kids volunteering to work for that committee. I interviewed one of the guys who was one of the assistants to Sprague, a guy named Al Lewis, and he said they had 12,000 applications, all right, for jobs. That's how much young kids coming out of college wanted to work for that committee, all right? And so you really had what a lot of people really believed now was going to be a real murder investigation into what the heck happened to President Kennedy. Now, let me add one other thing that I think your listeners should be cognizant of. Because these guys, and I'm referring to Sprague, Tannenbaum, and Al Lewis, all right, because these guys were so experienced, okay, in homicide cases, in murder cases, all right, when they got a look at the record of the JFK case, and by the way, this is not an all assumption, because I've talked to Tannenbaum and Lewis, interviewed them both for hours, and I have read interviews with Sprague, okay? So, like a two-hour interview, actually longer than that, like a four-hour interview. So I know what they thought of this. They were appalled at the evidence in the JFK case.
Jim, very briefly, we have not spoken much about the physical evidence, including CE-399, Commission Exhibit 399, the so-called magic bullet. By the way, Arlen Specter was the Warren Commission counsel who shepherded that one. Specter, by the way, was Richard Nixon's first choice as a defense attorney in Watergate, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But the physical evidence is absolutely bat bleep insane. You know, you could just pick the magic bullet, which was pristine despite having made I don't know how many different wounds, according to the official version, in JFK and Connally, shattering his wrist. And the material that was found in the wounds allegedly made by this pristine bullet exceeds the amount of material missing from the bullet, which is from the back of the bullet. The neutron activation analysis completely disproves this, although that was manipulated as well. The paraffin tests on Oswald were negative. He supposedly had fired 3 shots at JFK, and I believe it was 3 at Tippit, if I'm remembering correctly.
And it was actually 4.
4. There is no way you fire 3 shots from a bolt-action rifle and then 4 shots from a revolver and have no nitrate residue on it. It just doesn't happen. The rifle, aside from the fact it was a lousy rifle.
There was no nitrates on his face.
Yeah.
Now, if anybody's ever seen a Mannlicher Kirkconnell rifle where you have to actually work the bolt, you know, and then bring the bolt backwards to eject the shell, and then press the bolt back forward and then down, okay, and you not get any nitrate traces on your cheek. I mean, that is really a very hard thing to imagine.
And the rifle was
what the state of the evidence was at that time.
The rifle was, I've forgotten whether Oswald was left-handed or right-handed, aside from the fact it was a lousy shot. The rifle was sighted in for someone, the scope sighted in for someone who was shooting with the other hand. FBI's top ballistics experts could not duplicate what Oswald allegedly did, and they were much better shots. And one could go on. I mean, it just is completely ridiculous. And so any serious investigation.
By the way, let me add to that.
Sure.
It's not just that the FBI couldn't do it. Nobody has been able to do what Oswald did on their first pass. Okay, there's a lot of BS about this issue, especially by Gerald Posner. There's a debate that he had with Roger Stone down in Florida a year or two ago about this issue. And Posner, you know, everybody knows who he is. He authored this terrible book called Case Closed.
And did a similar thing with the Martin Luther King assassination as well.
Right, yes, okay. And he said, no, it has been done. It has never been done by anybody without cheating. The Warren Commission cheated because what they did is that they did it from 3 stories up at a not moving target, at a stationary target. That's how they duplicated what Oswald did. And then only one guy did it. Only one guy. They had 3 riflemen, master riflemen, trying it. Okay. And then only one guy did it, and he had to cheat. Okay. Now CBS did it, and they cheated. I go into a whole long story about that. But just let me say this. The target they ended up devising was 2.5 times as large as the actual target area on the back of JFK's head and the top of his shoulders. So they cheated without telling the audience that they did it. Okay, now, to me, the best testimony about whether anybody could do what Oswald did, which is getting 3 shots off in 6 seconds with a bolt-action rifle, 2 direct hits out of the 3, is by a guy named Carlos Hathcock. Carlos Hathcock was the finest sniper of the whole Vietnam War era. He had something like 96 confirmed kills, which means he had a spotter. If you go to how many he had unconfirmed, it was over 200. He was so lethal that the North Vietnamese put out a bounty on his head. Okay? All right? Well, after he retired, he created his own SWAT team school in Virginia. And the police departments from all over the country would send policemen to his school, all right, to learn how to do these kind of things. And so a guy, an author, who wrote a book on this case called The Kill Zone, all right, interviewed Hathcock, and he said, when you were running that SWAT school, did you ever try and do what the Warren Commission said Oswald did? And Hathcock said, Craig, I can't tell you how many times we tried it. And we did everything right. We were up from six stories. We did the measuring of the distance to the target. It was a moving target and everything. I couldn't do it. That is the greatest sniper of the whole Vietnam War. He had the record for the longest kill shot for something like 27 years. He hit a guy from a mile and a half away. Okay? And he says he couldn't do it. Yep. What else? I mean, really, this is absurd.
Well, okay? You know, that even beyond that, the physical evidence itself is so anomalous. It not only didn't happen the way the Warren Commission said it did, it could not have happened the way they said it did.
It's the wrong bullet, and it's the wrong rifle. I don't know how many of your listeners know that, but the late John Hunt, who just passed away, okay, he went down to the National Archives, and he wanted to go ahead and take a look at either the actual bullet CE-399 or the larger-than-life photographs of that exhibit, which, of course, is commonly called the magic bullet, all right, because he wanted to check out to see if the actual initials that Hoover said were on the bullet are there, because the story is that the Secret Service handed the bullet to Elmer Lee Todd, the FBI agent, at the White House at, I believe, around 8:50 that night, okay? And there's a signed receipt for that, all right? And so then Elmer Lee Todd went ahead and drove it down to FBI headquarters, all right? And he handed it to a guy named Robert Frazier, who was a technician doing the tests and the photographs of the bullet, all right? And so now Hoover told the Warren Commission that Elmer Lee Todd's initials are on the bullet, and that's how they know that that's the bullet that was delivered from Dallas. Well, guess what, Dave? John Hunt went down there with a microscope, and Elmer Lee Todd's initials are not on the bullet.
You mean they lied? I find that hard to believe, Jim.
Well, it's kind of par for the course with Hoover.
Well, I know. I mean, my dry sarcasm here should maybe
I want to tell you something even better.
Sure, go ahead.
In Robert Frazier's notes, get this, he wrote down that he was in receipt of what he called the stretcher bullet at 7:30. Yep. So here's my question. If Elmer Lee Todd didn't deliver the bullet till after 9 o'clock, how could Frazier be in receipt of the bullet at 7:30?
Well, obviously, that if somebody is lying, and even vis-a-vis CE-399, that bullet, as I think it was Harold Weisberg, himself a former FBI agent and an associate of Jim Garrison, observed, the bullet which had made all of these wounds in both JFK and John Connally. At one point, I believe, executing a short turn in midair without being acted upon by an outside force in direct contravention of the law of inertia. And it then somehow, as Weisberg put, became the only object in the known history of the physical universe to develop independent reverse momentum and somehow worked itself not on but under the stretcher that was taken from the car. So it, I think it was Connally's stretcher. So that it is absolute.
Well, we don't know whose stretcher was found on. Okay, Daryl Tomlinson was very angry and upset about the way that Arlen Specter cross-examined him to get him to say that it was supposedly on Connally's stretcher. If you take a look at Josiah Thompson's book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, he goes over this whole issue for a number of pages. He comes to the conclusion that it was not Connally's stretcher. It was a young child named Ronald Fuller, who I think was about 12.
Right, yes.
Found actually on his stretcher.
Somebody took a bullet and put it on a stretcher, and they got the wrong stretcher.
Right. Yep. Now, what other evidence, do you need to let you know that there was a frame-up involved, then they got the wrong stretcher? Okay,
sure.
Put the bullet on the wrong stretcher.
Well, none of the things that we have spoken about would make any sense at all. Oswald, the Marxist Marine, goes over to the Soviet Union, comes back, no sweat, hanging out with white Russians, anti-Castro Cubans, CIA people working for defense-related firms like Jagger's Child Stovall and Riley Coffee Company. And then he's hanging out with the Paynes, the whole Mexico City gambit. And the on October 9th, the flash notice is taken off his FBI file. It is, none of it makes any sense unless one is viewing the handling of this fellow as the creation of a patsy and the legend, the intelligence community official story that was being cobbled together to do that. But the physical evidence is a joke, absolute joke.
Yeah, and by the way, let me say one last thing about that physical evidence that Tannenbaum and Sprague and Lewis looked at, okay? Al Lewis, when I interviewed him at his office in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he said to me that one of the things that they were really taken aback by was the autopsy evidence in the JFK case. And I said words of the effect, when he said that, I said words of the effect, Harold Weisberg said that the President of the United States got the equivalent of an autopsy that you would give to a Bowery bum. And Lewis said to me, it's even worse than that. And I asked him to elucidate on that, but he didn't want to go any further. But that tells you how bad that the state of the evidence was when you have a professional prosecutor going ahead and saying he can't really express in words how bad the medical evidence is in the JFK case. All right, well, because it is. Any honest lawyer would tell you that the medical evidence in the JFK case is kind of so bizarre, you can't really believe it happened. That's how bad it was.
It really is. And they continue to generate, quote, expert, unquote, justification for that. They had a Lawrence Livermore guy saying, proposing that jet effect that we talked about a few weeks ago. Another alumnus of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, Kenneth A. Vaughn, has devoted a website to reinforcing a lot of the official nonsense as well. So this continues to be put forward by, quote, people in authority, unquote, who would, quote, know, unquote. And the big lie continues, and its dissemination is ongoing. Jim, we've spoken about Robert Tannenbaum, Al Lewis, Richard Sprague. There is someone who did some yeoman-like work for the House Select Committee. I have not spoken about him a great deal on this program. He passed away a few years ago, and that is Gaetan Fonzie. Tell us about Fonzie and some of the things that he looked into.
Gaetan Fonzie was originally a writer based in Philadelphia, and he had written a couple of rather distinguished articles on the JFK case, all right? One of them being a long interview with Arlen Specter in, I think, 1966, which really embarrassed Specter. All right, well, Richard Schweiker, when he and Gary Hart went ahead and took over the Schweiker-Hart Committee for the as a subset of the Church Committee, he remembered those articles because Schweiker was from Philadelphia. And so he got Gaetan Fonzie to come up and become an investigator for the Church Committee. And Gaten Fonzie did a very, very good job. He was concentrating his efforts on the Cuban exiles in Florida, okay? And he came up with some rather interesting discoveries, right? And he was starting to go ahead and building a case for their possible culpability in Kennedy's assassination. And when Tannenbaum came to Washington, he went ahead and interviewed Schweiker, and he brought his assistant detective with him, a guy named Cliff Fenton. All right, and so after about a half an hour, Schweiker told him, "Can you please ask Cliff to leave? There's something I want to talk to you in private about." All right, and so Cliff left, and Schweiker took out this file that Fonzie had put together on the Cuban exiles in Florida. All right, and he took it out of his desk. He went over to Tannenbaum, handed it to him, and he said, "The CIA killed President Kennedy." All right. So Tannenbaum and Fenton went back to Tannenbaum's rented apartment, and they read that file till about 6 o'clock in the morning. All right. And then when they were done, Fenton was about to leave, and he told Tannenbaum, "Bob, we're in way over our heads here." Okay, and Bob said, "I understand, but we were hired to do a job, and we're going to try and do it." Okay? And those were kind of famous last words, of course, because they didn't get to do the job. Okay?
We're going to talk about the... When really, you, in your chapter about the Clay Shaw trial, you titled it Anticlimax. I think some not unrelated title might have been, might be applied to the treatment accorded people like Richard Sprague and others, because when, as Tommy Baumler observed, one of Bannister's investigators, in an interview with Harold Weisberg, he said, quote, "Federal power will see to it that Clay Shaw will not be convicted, nor will," I'm paraphrasing slightly, "nor will anyone else in connection with this case." And that ultimately the federal power did become manifest in connection with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. But giving people credit for what they did, Gaten Fonzie, tell us about some of the things that he was working on before the portcullis of federal power descended on the investigation itself.
There's two things that he did a very fine job on. That is tracing this guy named Maurice Bishop, all right, who several people had said was associated with the whole Cuban exile effort, okay, in 61, 62, and 63, all right, and was organizing certain raids, all right, into Cuba, and was working with some of the more militant guys in the Cuban exile community, all right? And so after getting several people, all right, to go on the record about this guy, he put together a description, and Schweiker brought in an artist, okay, to do a drawing, all right? And so after he went ahead and put together the drawing, okay, he showed it to Schweiker, and Schweiker said in about, 2 seconds, "That's Dave Phillips," all right? And so he got other confirmation, and most people believe today, that this Bishop guy was Phillips. Now, the reason that's important is because we found out later that three things. Number one, Phillips was running the CIA's anti-Fair Play for Cuba Committee campaign. All right, number one. Number two, he was seen in Guy Bannister's office in 1961. And number three, he was seen in Cuban exile training camp films along with Bannister and Oswald.
And David Ferry, as I recall.
And then, I think Ferry actually took the film.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's the suspicion. And Tannenbaum had this film, okay? And he brought in witnesses. And that's how they confirmed that it was them. Now, the other thing that Gayton did such a very good job on was a guy named Bernardo de Torres, all right? Bernardo de Torres was a veteran of the Bay of Pigs, all right, who was bailed out of Cuba early 1963. He was kind of like one of these Luis Posada Carrillos guys. He's one of these heavy-duty, very violent reputation, okay, as one of these Cuban exiles, all right, who they found a friend of. Okay, the House Select Committee found a friend of, and he talked about the fact that de Torres talked about the Kennedy assassination before it happened. Okay, and then he learned that de Torres, under disguise, was in Dealey Plaza that day, and that he took films. Or not films, I think pictures, still pictures, of what had happened. And he had the pictures stored in a safe deposit box in Miami. Life magazine had found out about him, all right, and they offered him quite a ducal sum, all right, but he was not going to let them go, all right? And I think it's very interesting that de Torres ended up being a business partner with the legendary Mitch Werbel. Okay, now you probably talked to him about several times on your show, right?
Sure, and we brought him up in the past. The Wizard of Whispering Death is one of his nicknames, and the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, manufactured the Ingram Mach-10 and Mach-11 silenced machine pistols,
right,
and ran the Cobra Mercenary Training School down in Georgia.
Right, and some people suspect that he designed the weapons used in Dealey Plaza, all right?
Indeed.
Because he had what they called a suppressor device, which he mapped. To go into Mitch Werbel's career, he was sort of like the Einstein of silenced weapons. You know, he actually put together a graph saying that if you ever got somebody in a crossfire using these suppressors, we call them silencers today, all right, nobody would be able to go ahead and detect with any accuracy from which direction the shots were coming from, okay? Because if you were in a certain radius, of the actual shot, it would sound like it's coming the other way.
Yep.
Okay, because the suppressor went ahead and held down the first explosion, which takes place in the rifle. But you would hear the second explosion, which is the bullet breaking the sound barrier.
The shockwave, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but when that happened, the bullet's already out of the rifle and traveling to the target.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, very quickly, Jim, you mentioned Luis Posada Carriles, veteran anti-Castro Cuban operative for CIA. And eventually he was involved with the bombing of a Venezuelan, was it Venezuelan? Anyway, it had the Cuban national fencing team, and it was blown up in midair. That actually was part of the Operation Condor assassination consortium of Latin American countries, one of the killings of which was the assassination of Orlando Letelier. And William Davy links de Torres to that. So they actually collaborated on were part of the same operational milieu for some time. And Posada Carriles then was in the Iran-Contra affair. His name surfaced working once again with George Bush and company. So that's who that person is.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Another person, another focal point that Gaetan Fonzi looked into was Sergio Arcacha Smith. We've spoken about him in the past. We might want to mention his apparent links with Jack Ruby, Thomas Eli Davis, and gunrunning.
Well, look, Sergio Arcacha Smith, I believe, is really a very, very important figure. All right. Gaetan Fonzi got on to Sergio Arcacha Smith through Jim Garrison, right? Because in the early days of the House Select Committee, they were cooperating with Garrison. Tannenbaum and Sprague went ahead and commissioned a meeting, you know, between people like Jonathan Blackmer, a young lawyer, Fonzi, the investigator, and Jim Garrison. And Garrison brought in a lot of his files and showed them to him, and Sergio Arcacha Smith was a prominent figure in those files. Well, it turns out that Sergio Arcacha Smith was, first of all, very heavily involved in gun running in the southeastern quadrant of Florida. And the only way you can do that, to the extent he was doing it, is you have some kind of CIA clearance, which Smith did. Sergio Arcacha Smith did have a CIA clearance, right? Now, he was also found by one of Garrison's investigators, and this is in the House Select Committee report because Gaetan Fonzi brought up those files. He was also found to be in the car that Rose Sheremy was thrown out of a couple of days before the Kennedy assassination, and which she later reportedly said that people in the hospital, that these two guys were talking about killing Kennedy. All right? See, when that was shown, if you remember, in the first part of Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, a lot of people said, what the hell is this? Why is he making this stuff up? He didn't make up anything.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. You know, all right. And so Sergio Arcacha Smith was one of the guys that Garrison identified as being in the car when she was thrown out. All right. Okay. And then, of course, the rather fascinating interview that they did with a guy named Francis Frugier, who was a investigator for Garrison. They brought him up to the House Select Committee, and during one of his interviews, he said kind of offhandedly, by the way, did you guys ever learn about those maps of Dealey Plaza that Sergio Arcacha Smith had in his apartment in Dallas? Can you imagine just saying that offhandedly at the end of an interview?
Okay. Doesn't everybody keep schematics of the Dealey Plaza sewer system in their apartment? I mean, I've got one up on my wall.
Who does that? You know?
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm joking, by the way. I mean, of course. And the fact that he may have had that, I mean, I don't know if what Frugier said has ever been confirmed, but it certainly is interesting, and there has been discussion that somehow the sewer system in Dealey Plaza may have been used either as a sniper's perch or a gunman's perch, or perhaps and or for escape purposes.
Right. It'd be a terrific way to escape.
Yep.
Okay, because all you would have to do is just lift up the storm drain and just jump down below. And who the heck is going to do that? Who's going to look for you? Just wait for a few hours till nighttime, okay? And you go ahead and your accomplice is all clear, and you're out of there.
You literally go underground. Yep, absolutely.
So those are the kind of things that Fonzie was investigating.
And, Sergio Acosta-Smith, a fellow who was in so many, figures in so many different aspects of the investigation. Then Texas Governor John Conley refused to extradite him to New Orleans for Garrison's investigation. And he really is a very important fellow. I think it was Hugh Ainsworth who interdicted Garrison's attempts at interviewing Acosta-Smith.
Yes, and that's also true.
And gamed that one with the Dallas police. Something else that Gaetan Fonzie looked into, and that is a subject that we have spoken about before, and that is Freeport Sulphur. Tell us about Freeport Sulphur.
This is very interesting.
Jock Whitney and how he figures into this. Go ahead.
Freeport Sulphur was a company set up by a New York City newspaper publisher, Jock Whitney, a multimillionaire. All right. He published a New York Herald Tribune. Now, he set up this sulfur company in, I believe, the 30s or 40s, and it was operating in Cuba, all right, in the early 1960s. Garrison and Fonzie both found out that Clay Shaw and David Ferry were actually associated with Freeport Sulphur, because when Castro came to power, he was threatening to expropriate a lot of properties. So what they wanted to do was to set up a transfer from Cuba to Canada, which did not have an embargo on Cuba at the time, in order to process the nickel plate, that you use in sulfur manufacturing, and then bring it back into the United States. And Fonzie and Garrison actually found out about several witnesses that Shaw and Ferry were involved in this scheme, And beyond that, some of the other people were associated with this company. I mean, it wasn't just Jock Whitney. There were people like Arleigh Burke, the former chief of staff of the Navy, people from the Rockefeller family that were also involved, like Godfrey Rockefeller, all right? And it ended up being, in other words, if you wanted a cross-section of people who were involved and had a reason to despise Kennedy, and be a part of a kind of wide-ranging conspiracy, you couldn't get very much better than Freeport Sulphur. And one last thing about Jock Whitney. On the night of the assassination, he very surprisingly wandered into the office of the New York Herald Tribune, and because his excuse was they were shorthanded that night, and he supervised an editorial that was based, the rough theme is how sociopaths have won off and killed presidents in now the present and the past, Now, his newspaper, I think, was the first one to go ahead and pound out that line, that somehow Oswald was a sociopath. But what makes it so interesting is that the first meeting of the Warren Commission, which was going to be just a couple of weeks later, Alan Dulles passed out a book, I think it's called The Assassins.
Correct.
In which, as he was passing it out, he explained, all these cases have been done by one person. And I think McCloy mildly objected, and he said, well, what about the Lincoln case? And Dulles said, well, it was really just one guy, who tried to kill Lincoln.
By the way, you
probably know, right?
Yep. Well, yeah.
There were something like 14 people rounded up.
Well, not only that, but there was a book that I used as the focal point of, for the record, 691, That killing was organized by the Confederate Secret Service using members of Mosby's Rangers. John Wilkes Booth was part of Mosby's battalion. I think he may have been a non-commissioned officer. If you look at the roster of Mosby's battalion, there's a J.B. Wilkes, which is John Wilkes Booth's stage name. And it was a killing that was arranged by the Confederate Secret Service. There is absolute, very firm information about that. And by the way, the head of the Confederate Secret Service, General Albert Pike, was the co-founder of the Ku Klux Klan. Most people know about General Nathan Bedford Forrest. He was actually the co-founder, along with Albert Pike, the chief of intelligence for the Confederacy. So yes, but that won't stop Alan Dulles.
So those are the kind of things that Gayton Fonzie was coming up with, all right? Some very, very, very interesting stuff. And, of course, when Tannenbaum read that file, all right, he decided that he was going to go ahead and offer Gayton a job with the House Select Committee, which he accepted.
And in the obituaries of Gayton Fonzie, he passed away a few years ago. Even in the obituaries, as they did with Jim Garrison, the kind of spun it to make it out that he was kind of a zealot. He was, I forgot what nickname he was accorded by fellow, quote, investigators, unquote. But they couldn't even play the obituary straight. They made it out that he was kind of, a little over-enthusiastic. Most discouraging. By the way, we mentioned David Phillips and in what was, if not a deathbed confession, a dying confession, because he was terminally ill, with his estranged brother in 1988, he revealed that he had, in fact, been in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And so these people did a very good job, something, and we're going to get into what happened to the House Select Committee, bearing in mind Tommy Baumler's observation about the fact that federal power would see to it that Clay Shaw would not be convicted, and neither would anyone else in connection with the assassination. But the House Select Committee on Assassinations Assistant Counsel Jonathan Blackmer, B-L-A-C-K-M-E-R, wrote, "We have reason to believe that Shaw," that's Clay Shaw, "was heavily involved in the anti-Castro efforts in New Orleans in the 1960s and was possibly one of the high-level planners or cutout to the planners of the assassination." The fact that the investigative vector of the House Select Committee would have been going in that direction, which, of course, is where Jim Garrison was going, I think will inform listeners as to some of the things that we are going to relate in our next interview when we talk about what happened when the coach turned back into a pumpkin, in connection with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Jim, we've got about 2.5 minutes left in this interview. If you would tell our listeners about how they can get not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK the Evidence Today. Tell us about Kennedy's and King and Black Op Radio, and apparently some information pertaining to the supervision of Kennedy's and King. Go ahead.
All right. The website that I supervise is called kennedysandking.com, and you can go ahead and punch through couple of ads there if you want to go ahead and order either of my two books, Don't Be Discussing Now, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, or my more recent book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. I do a semi-regular spot on Black Op Radio out of Vancouver, Canada, with Len Osanek. And also, our present webmaster is going to be retiring in a few months, and we're going to need a replacement for him on a purely voluntary basis, and it should be somebody who's kind of proficient with Joomla and has done this kind of thing before, HTML via Joomla. So you can just go ahead and email me at the site, kennedysandking.com, if you're interested, and I'll get in contact with you.
And there certainly will be any number of qualified people here in the Silicon Valley. So job opportunity, albeit volunteer, but you will be doing the Lord's work, so to speak. So that is something for people to contemplate. We're going to talk more about what happened with the House Select Committee, and that, however, will be in our next interview. This concludes For the Record, program number 1052, interview number 21 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 19th of the year 2019. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.